Hello and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a new fortnightly half-hour discussion about success, modern business and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore, your host for the day, and I'm joined this afternoon by my guest Clive Jackson, the founder and CEO of Victor, an on-demand private jet service for high-net-worth individuals. Clive's something of a serial entrepreneur, having founded 14 companies in his time, but his latest in that long line of successes is Victor. It's raised close to $28 million in funding and is often called the Uber of private jets. Today, Clive will be discussing celebrity investors, the habits that make great entrepreneurs, and how a goldfish put him in the Guinness Book of Records. Clive, thank you very, very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to take you back to the very first days of Victor. And I wonder where you were when you first kind of had that brainwave, because your background isn't in private jets particularly, is it?
No, it's not. And the, you know, the really first idea about how to disrupt this marketplace came and was born out of frustration, really. It was a rainy Friday afternoon in London. The weather was miserable. And I was thinking, where can I go in Europe? Who can I pick up the phone to? And, you know, lo and behold, I rang my jet charter broker and wanted to know what was available. Is there an empty leg going somewhere? Can I find the sun for a long weekend? And that was the sort of the spark of the whole process of understanding how the industry worked. And shortly after that, I met my broker, who happened to live across the river from me in Henley. So what was meant to be an hour's catch up and him find out about the needs of his customer, I turned that into about a 6 or 7 hour meeting and found out how the industry worked and didn't work. And I tucked that away in the back of my mind thinking, I like it, but it does sound pretty archaic.
Right. And what didn't work about it specifically?
Well, fundamentally, as a consumer, I was kept completely at arm's length from the supply chain. So for me to make a decision about chartering a private jet to Milan, I had no idea about what it really cost, who the operator was going to be. And obviously, when you get into a small aircraft and fly at 46,000 feet, you kind of want to know that. And how old the aircraft is going to be. You know, and none of that was going to be shared with me until I had already made the commitment and passed over some money.
Right.
So
it was a transparency issue largely.
A control issue, and as a control freak in terms of, you know, someone who wants to know how everything works, who takes what out of the equation, so on and so forth. I just felt disempowered. And when I looked at the industry, that's pretty much how it works. 80% of all private jet charter around the world is managed through intermediaries. And the intermediary's job is to keep you, the consumer, at arm's length from their supply, because they make their money by putting a margin on the flight. But you as a consumer have just got to accept the fact that you are, you know, at the end of the value chain. You have to commit your money before they'll tell you who the operator is. And that was the fundamental driver in my mind as to, this industry is pretty archaic. It's based on phone calls, occasionally emails, and digital plays no part in the potential disruption of the value chain. And that was back in 2010.
Yeah. And did you find out at that early stage that other people felt the same way as you? Was it easy to kind of get early feedback from people in your position?
Well, the principle being that if you could afford a private jet and you were flying private because you wanted to fly private, and that meant two things. First of all, you chose where you went, how you went, what time you went, and the type of aircraft that you were going to fly in. So if it was a business trip over to Milan, I would invariably be flying with my CMO and CFO, and we'd probably be going over there for a business deal. So we'd want to work on the aircraft. I mean, we're not going to have a highly sensitive commercial conversation flying EasyJet or British Airways into Milan. You know, the idea of being able to choose and understand what you were flying and how you were flying was one of the key drivers.
You mentioned earlier that you started it in 2010, which was kind of in the depths of one of the most brutal recessions of recent times. Did that make it particularly difficult, especially as it was an industry that was all about high net worths who might have been losing quite a lot of money at that point?
Yeah, getting that close to, you know, the demise of Lehman and, you know, the whole, you know, credit crunch was always going to be a big challenge, particularly if you were going to come to the market with a new business. But in 2010, that's where the idea got seeded.
Yeah.
What really triggered me to do something about it was flying back from Mallorca, where I have a second home.
Right.
British Airways in November 2010 decided, again in the depths of the recession, that they would cancel all scheduled services.
Oh, wow.
From Gatwick.
Yeah.
And in the same week, British Midlands, who flew from Heathrow, decided they were going to cancel all scheduled services.
Wow.
So in the low season to get to your second home, I think we were faced with, I and many others were faced with, one or two flights a week.
Okay.
So if you were commuting,
yeah,
it was just game over. And, you know, that's where the whole idea started. So I was aware of the industry. I was aware of what wasn't working in the industry. But getting off that plane thinking, I actually can't get to work or I can't get home, was probably the single biggest driver to it. And seven other like-minded people that I'd spoken to on that last flight back into Heathrow said, listen, Clive, if you can put a plane on and we share it out, give me a call. That seems to sound like a good idea. And, you know, I left the aircraft with seven business cards in my pocket thinking, what have I let myself in for?
And did you organize flights immediately? Was it straight away you chartered a jet and got these seven people on it?
No, not straight away. I mean, that was in November. Because I owned a digital communications agency, which was, you know, one of the leading ones in the country at the time, I asked my head creative to knock me up a quick website and called flyingmallorca.com. It's a really catchy title. And to direct and receive the interest from those seven people and hopefully a couple of their friends, because just seven people would never make the economics work.
No.
And by Christmas, I think we'd had 100 people registering on the website saying, listen, count me in if you're going out for Easter, count me in if you're going out for half term. And that then made me think, well, you know, is there something here than just me going backwards and forwards to the island of Mallorca? Could we do something sensible?
How quickly did you think we need to start raising money for this and this could actually be a viable business?
Well, in January, we'd now climbed to about 200. So the first thing I did in January was canvass the 200 and said and asked them who would like to join me on a focus group. It's a free lunch and two really nice restaurants, the Square in Berkeley Square and Mark Foch down in Palma de Mallorca. So both Michelin star restaurants.
Right. Work.
And I asked whoever would like to come along to come and talk to me about their experiences flying private. Would they like to? Had they flown before? And to share their frustrations. But most importantly, to help me scope out a new model. You know, how would we do this differently and better based on my experiences, which predominantly were around this complete lack of control, this lack of transparency, and just not knowing who was charging what for a service.
Yeah.
And that those two focus groups proved to be pivotal to then a business plan being created and written in a long weekend.
Right.
And by March, I had put the initial seed capital into the business and embarked upon building a minimal viable product, the whole MVP lean startup play. Yeah. And that happened in 2011.
And how important do you think it is for entrepreneurs to put some skin in the game? You invested some money, but do you think it's helpful if they've got their own money on the table, or do you think that can sometimes sway their judgment a bit?
Well, I think there are two perspectives. I mean, first of all, from an entrepreneurial perspective, putting some skin in the game, you know, absolutely demonstrates to yourself more than anything else that you are willing to risk something.
Yeah.
This is not a fad. This is not just a good idea that 3 months later, 6 months later, you walk away from. So being willing to write a check and that amount to be significant enough for it to hurt if it goes wrong really helps you test your resolve as a budding entrepreneur as to whether you want to make those sacrifices. Obviously, over time, once you take money in from third parties and other investors, friends, family, angels, that creates a huge amount of comfort for them that you do have some skin in the game. Mm. And it also says to you, it's not just your money that you might lose. So some point, the commitment that you've made that keeps you really focused and going through, you know, a succession of pain barriers is no longer about whether you're willing to walk away from your sunk capital.
Right.
It's now about your commitment that you have to your shareholders. And that's how I feel to this day. You know, what I've invested in Victor is my sunk capital. But what I have taken over the course of 4 years is circa 28 million US, which is not an insubstantial amount from friends, family, ultra high net worths, and a considerable amount of people who fly Victor.
So when it comes to raising that money, how important do you think the language around a startup is? Do you think it's very important to have a snappy kind of elevator pitch and a top line thought? Or do you think it's maybe more important to have a good numbers, or is it a combination of the two perhaps?
Well, I think, and those are two really good questions. First of all, whatever numbers you might have in a startup business, they are just projections. Yeah. And you might model them out 1, 2, 3, 4 years, but you're modeling a projection on a projection on a projection. So frankly, you have really no idea about whether you are going to hit that target or not. So fundamentally, it comes down to the idea and the people behind the idea, and whether or not they have the necessary motivation, commitment, and skills, and whether they are sufficiently self-aware to be able to deliver on that idea. So to your second point, can you articulate it? Absolutely, that's essential. You know, the time that you have to present this new idea to a prospective investor, notwithstanding their willingness to listen to something in depth, you have to create that elevator pitch. You have to succinctly map out what you're trying to do, why it's important, why you have an angle, and why you think you're likely to win. And winning is not where you'll be in 3, 5, 6, 7, 8 years' time at a $1 billion company. It's whether or not you'll get through those first 1 or 2 years before you require more capital.
So what was the Victor elevator pitch back then, and has it changed in the last few years, or is it still very much the same?
We came to the market initially with the idea that we would create a private jet share community. Yeah. So, you know, that was around solving my problem, going backwards and forwards to Mallorca. When we launched, we were 6 months into that launch, and there was the Greek debt crisis.
Of course.
And what was really interesting about that is that most operators were suffering dreadfully at the time, and they were flying you into wherever you were going, and Milan or Munich or Geneva was a good example, but they'd leave the plane there. They'd park the plane up, fly the crew home on EasyJet because there was no other booking for 2, 3, 4, 5 days. So why keep the crew stuck at Geneva Airport in a hotel waiting for the next booking to come? So invariably, it meant that the asset that we were working with, which was a plane going out being shared, and B, an empty leg coming back that could be sold, half of our market pretty much evaporated overnight. So we pivoted.
Yeah.
And the pivot was follow the money. And the money was effectively those that could afford a whole jet to charter for themselves, that weren't reliant on other people joining them to make it happen.
Yeah.
So we'd experimented with the jet share community. It did work on key routes at key times of the year, but fundamentally, could we create then a service that mapped into the ultra high net worth who wanted on-demand private jet charter?
Yeah.
And that was our first really major pivot.
You spoke earlier about the people behind the business. How did you go about building that team early on? Because you must have had hundreds of people working with you across the years. Did you recruit old friends, or was it new people coming to you, or was it maybe a mixture of the two?
Initially, it was all new.
Yeah.
And when I started Victor, I didn't really know anything about the private jet industry. What I did know was how to build e-commerce systems, platforms, booking portals, servicing the luxury end of the market. So over the years, I've worked for brands like Bentley and Jaguar and Land Rover and Porsche cars and Ferrari, some really great, you know, automotive luxury brands, travel brands, so on and so forth. So understanding how to engage the ultra high net worth consumer, understanding what makes them tick, understand how to build a brand and deliver a service, that was my expertise.
Yeah.
Private aviation wasn't.
No.
I'm a problem solver. So part of that problem solving exercise is to surround yourself by people who are from within the industry who can give you that expertise. Invariably, they're not going to solve all the problems for you because historically they're part of the problem.
Yeah.
But they're smart enough to realize that someone could come along and change it. And in that instance, you know, from my experiences, that the people that I brought on who are still with me to this day decided to... you know, peg themselves to my my particular flag and work with me on this. You know, the biggest challenge for any business today, and particularly one that's, you know, under pressure to perform, is getting your hiring right.
Yeah.
And you're never going to get it totally right.
No.
You invariably get out what you put in. Sometimes you're unlucky. And, you know, not everyone that you hire works out.
Sure.
So, you know, my advice and comment to anyone in this space is, if you shortcut the process, you will pay for that at some point, you know, along the way. And, you know, that is the single biggest challenge, getting like-minded people together who are willing to put themselves through a lot of pain in the early stages of a startup business.
Yeah.
Because it's not particularly glamorous. You are on a mission.
Sure.
You're not getting paid very well, if at all. And for the first 3 years in Victor, you know, I didn't get paid anything.
Mm.
I wasn't going to pay myself.
No.
And whatever capital I put in, I'd much rather use that to pay someone else to do a job. So, yeah, it's interesting challenge facing people.
And I want to talk for a bit about the market itself. There's a kind of a thread going through your career of working with and for these ultra high net worths. How much do you think that market has changed? That specific niche of the market has changed maybe in the last 10 years, certainly since the recession?
That's a good question. And I think, you know, fundamentally, the misconception about ultra high net worths is that, first of all, they're all old people and they have no idea what technology is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was quite happy for that myth to be perpetuated by my competitors. Because the desire to want to take an archaic business kicking and screaming online and into a multi or omni-channel platform was my particular challenge. From my experiences, those that have made money because they're smart. And if they're smart, they're going to figure out pretty much any way, any technology, any opportunity to do things faster, quicker, and more efficiently.
Sure.
And in the early days of Victor, we were targeting the first ever iPhone, the first ever iPad as a channel to communicate. So the smart ultra high net worths got that. Today, they get it even more so.
Okay.
And, you know, I think today, the way that technology plays a part in their lives in terms of how they manage their companies, their people, their enterprises, their investment portfolios, just keeping abreast of what's going on in the world. Today, it is ubiquitous.
Yeah.
It is an essential part of their tool set.
And you mentioned there some competitors. I suppose the biggest one might be JetSmarter in the US. And they've just closed, I think, before Christmas, $105 million funding round. Does that kind of money worry you as a competitor, or does it encourage you that there's a real demand out there? Or are they not quite in the same game as you? Is it a different fight?
Well, again, a great question. And, you know, I'm going to answer that both from an entrepreneur with an early stage startup, and then someone who now has proven their model in our space. So I think, first of all, anyone coming into the market with substantial capital to deploy says one thing. It says that someone has believed them enough to want to write a check.
Yeah.
And when I started Victor without any real competitors in the digital online on-demand space, you know, it always raises the eyebrow that either you're too far ahead of the game or you're actually barking up the wrong tree. So having someone come in the market with capital to deploy to the tune of JetSmarter, I think is great news for us and for the industry, because I think it raises the awareness. I think the challenge for Victor today is to ensure that you don't get consumed by trying to compete with a model that's not the same as yours.
Yeah.
So for Victor, it is very much about a free to use, free to choose, no membership, no upfront fees for a completely transparent on-demand service where you are flying private. Mm-hmm. So the whole essence of flying private is you choose the date, the time, the aircraft that matches what you want to do on board, and you pay for that service, and Victor delivers a pretty good service around that, both from a technical standpoint and also from a service standpoint. And, you know, we're now 4.5, 5 years into the equation, and we're the undisputed fastest growing in this space. So I think JetSmarter and Victor are probably in the same ballpark in terms of volume of charter. I think we just beat them in 2016 for whole jet charter. But they offer a different model, which is it's a membership model. You pay $5,000 up front, $10,000 a year, and you know there's about 40 routes around the world where you, as an individual, can get a free seat. That's a different model. That's more a shuttle model on a small plane. We're a on-demand private jet charter business, and it is different.
One of their investors, in fact, was, I'm not sure if you saw, Jay-Z, the rapper. Do you think that kind of celebrity endorsement is a good thing? Or do you think it distracts and perhaps puts off the brand image?
Well, I like the way that you said the rapper.
I'm sure you know who he is, but perhaps some of our readers aren't necessarily too well versed in hip hop, but everyone knows Jay-Z, I guess.
I guess so. And you know, we have our own celebrity investors in Victor too.
Any you can name now?
Under the UK company house rules, they're all available on the shareholder register. So probably the most famous, more gold discs and platinum discs than you could you know, count on your on two hands. That's Sir Elton John.
Wow.
So you know, a phenomenal artist and songwriter and performer. That's an absolute legend. But in all seriousness, does it really help a brand or a business? It can do, but I think fundamentally this is all about the service. It depends whether or not your audience is aspiring to be like them, to want to fly with them. I'm not sure whether Jay-Z would want you to fly with him. But fundamentally, from our perspective, our success and being able to grow at the rate of, I think we just clocked 950% over the last 4 years of growth. You know, you only get that because the value proposition resonates with your audience and the quality of service actually is deliverable.
And what is it that you found so far most of your users actually want to do on the jet? Is it mainly work and CEOs, or is it some people who want to do it for relaxation, the glamour, maybe to party, or is it some people doing it to show off, do you think, when they arrive in a different country?
Well, I think if you'd asked me a couple of years ago, the vast majority of Victor's flying customers, and bearing in mind when you start from scratch, you have no customers, so they are coming from somewhere. The Victor customer base came from brokers that weren't offering a transparent model. Our customers came to us because they were intrigued that we were offering transparency and control. We were providing a slick app and a slick website. But fundamentally, you know, they like the service. And today, when you look at what they're doing and why they're doing it, I think in the last 12 months, we've had something like 15% of our growth has come from people who've never flown private. So maybe you're right in saying that perhaps there is an element of arriving. There's an element of status there. But fundamentally, people are doing it because it saves them a huge amount of time. And what they can't change is the fact that there are only 24 hours in the day. But what they can do is get from London out to Munich, do a business meeting in the morning, move on to Zurich, do one in the afternoon, and then be back in London for supper. And that use of their time and achieving all of that, if you had to fly commercial, would just simply not be possible.
The negative spin maybe for private jets is that they are environmentally quite unfriendly. Is that something you offset? Is that something you're aware of and that you have to try and deal with?
Well, I think the whole issue of air travel and, you know, the carbon output from fuel burn, whether it's an internal combustion car or whether it's a jet or whether it's a 787 flying across the Atlantic is always an issue. And I think today consumers are, you know, more environmentally conscious. And certainly the more wealthy the consumer, the more travel that they will tend to do, it's not always the case, the more they will look at these issues, both in terms of their personal life and in terms of the businesses and companies they own. So what I've seen with our customer base is that they are actually quite environmentally conscious. A lot of them run their own carbon offset policies across their organizations, and some of those extend it to their personal life in terms of their carbon consumption or the carbon output. And certainly they've got to make that value equation that whether they want to drive a Bentley, whether they want to have a mega yacht, whether they're going to fly first class across the Atlantic or on a private jet to Milan, they are conscious of that output. Yeah.
You often hear entrepreneurs talk about this as a kind of paranoia. They use that word, that paranoia is quite a positive thing if you're in business. Do you think that's true, that you need to be looking over your shoulder constantly?
Constantly. I think if you don't bring that fear into the boardroom, if you don't bring that fear to the start of every day, then I think you're in trouble. And all I can say from a personal perspective is that the two things, amongst others, that I do more than anything else is that when I'm shaving in the morning, I'm looking in the mirror thinking, whatever I did yesterday, what could I have done better?
Right.
So, fundamentally, whatever I do, I don't think it's good enough, period.
Sure.
And secondly, who could come along and disrupt that? And, if you are willing to be that paranoid about competitors, strategic partners who could become competitors in the future and understand how they could disrupt you as opposed to where there isn't that overlap, then I think you stand a better chance of success.
Sounds quite an exhausting thing though, to every morning almost be berating your past performances. Do you ever stop and pat yourself on the back and say, you've done a good job, Clive?
Yeah, occasionally, but I mean, frankly, what you tend to find is, and this is a relatively recent admission to myself, is that you become addicted to the pressure. You become addicted to that, where else are you going to get to play at this level with these sorts of stakes? So on the odd occasion where it's Saturday morning and there isn't three things that you have to do, that weekend, all of which will take you 24 hours a pop. So you've got 2 to 3 hours off. And I tend to think of my life in like that, little windows of 2 to 3 hours to myself occasionally in a week is a real luxury. You find yourself in a situation where you're missing the adrenaline.
Right. Okay.
So yes, you can become quite addicted to the pressure.
The stress hormone. Something to your veins.
I think the issue about stress and pressure is again one that will invariably need to differentiate in your own mind, because if what pressure that you're under you perceive as being stress, then that is going to probably kill you in the end.
Right.
You are going to get ill. You won't have the energy. You will be looking at the world from a lens which says, well, why me? Why is it all happening to me? If you relish the pressure and you don't see it as stress, then my whole approach to it is, well, look, there's going to be a whole lot of bad stuff happening throughout your life, throughout your day, throughout your week. Get used to it. On the odd occasion it's not bad, that's a bonus. So from that point of view, you condition yourself to dealing with that pressure, and you don't see it as being stressful.
So you're not new to digital. You founded Global Beach, one of the first digital agencies in the UK. And I think, if I'm right, you hold a Guinness World Record for some of your work there. What was that for?
Well, oddly enough, it was for a goldfish.
Right.
So it was a virtual pet. We're going back a few years here. So in 1997, going into 1998, I created an artificial intelligent engine, built a 3D goldfish, And we disseminated that over the internet. Yeah. So it sort of had the impression of living and breathing and developing a personality. And yeah. you as a consumer would have it living on your PC, turn your PC on in the morning, and there it was, pleased to see you. And yeah. you'd have to feed it and look after it. And we sort of developed it as a marketing exercise for Hewlett-Packard, and we called it Moppy, the pet fish. And the aspiration was that, you know, perhaps we will get 100,000 downloads. And in negotiating with Hewlett-Packard, they said, well, look, you know, how do you want to get paid?
Yeah.
We'll give you 50 cents a download, or we'll pay you, you know, an upfront fee.
Wow.
And of course, I took the upfront fee, as you would. And several years later, I think we did something like 26 million downloads.
Oh, my word.
So we were running alongside one other virtual creature that was yeah. being downloaded at the time, which was from the TV series Ally McBeal.
Okay.
And she had a dancing baby, and we had Moppy wow. the pet fish.
That's the most 90s
yeah.
thing I've ever heard.
Yeah,
an Ally McBeal yeah. downloadable desktop pet.
Yeah. So, I mean, what was interesting about it is that we went on to build, you know, spiders and, you know, tarantulas particularly, and scorpions that you could download from the internet. I think back then it was, you know, $9.99 to download, and then
wow.
I think $2 for a box of crickets that you would feed it. So they'd be jumping around the screen and chirping and that. And then just plugged it in. I mean, that was a true tech company. We just wow. plugged it into a server, sat back and, you know, watched the money tick over. And, you know, we did hundreds of thousands of those. So
printing money.
Yeah.
Really?
In, wow. in the ideal that, you know, you make money when you sleep.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was quite good fun building that. Wow.
And you spoke about that moment looking in the mirror. What daily habits do you think makes a good entrepreneur?
Wow. That's a difficult one to answer.
Well,
I mean,
then what are your daily habits that have become away from the office? Do you work out in the morning? Do you have a specific eating routine? Do you read at night? Is it something like that?
Yeah, probably all of the above. But yeah. I think, you know, fundamentally, the thing that I do as religiously as I can is work out to a
right.
degree where, you know, I'm probably at the point of killing myself at every session. And you know, God forbid if I drop down dead tomorrow, then you'll know I've overdone it. But,
okay.
You know, that idea of being able to push yourself to the limit is just part of my DNA
yeah.
makeup, knowing where the cracks are going to come and trying to avoid them.
Yeah.
But from a fitness regime, it's about discipline. And, you know, having, you know, a fitness regime that allows me to perform mentally and physically at a level that is hugely demanding,
sure.
you know, given my job, then, you know, that's an essential part of the equation.
And do you ever have a day off, 2 days off in a row? Do you ever go on holiday?
Yeah, that's a bit of a sore point at the moment,
right.
you know, so particularly with my wife. So I've had to cancel the pre-Christmas, the Christmas and the February holiday,
yeah.
Just because work commitments being what they are, it's very difficult to justify why I'm not going to be,
yeah.
you know, be in the office, or, you know, be in the office here in London or New York or California. But, you know, invariably once a year I will get
okay.
get 10 days, and that's...
And does your mind switch off? Do you allow yourself to not think about the business, or is it always kind of at the back of your mind?
I think as an entrepreneur, you know, you're sitting on the plane, you're talking to somebody flying over there,
yeah.
you're at the airport. I mean, the last decent vacation I had was on the island of St. Barts. So, you know, flying into probably the third most dangerous airstrip in the world, you know, which ends on the beach.
Yeah.
And it means you've got to fly through a gap in the hills to, and then dive down onto the runway. You know, you kind of think it would take your mind off things. But, you know, by the time I got to the airport terminal, I met the owner of the airport terminal and the owner of the guy whose plane I was flying on. And it was a small 8-seater
yeah.
Turboprop fantastic plane, fantastic landing. And 2 days later, I was doing a photo shoot at the end of the runway with his plane.
Right.
And a couple of local models that were available to do this photo shoot. So, you know, it's rare that you do switch off, but you don't see it as being a job. You see it as being something that is as pleasurable as going surfing.
And do you have, we're sitting here now in January, albeit the dying days of January. Are there any New Year's resolutions you've made that you think you'd like to stick to this year?
Yeah, obviously stay to the health regime. Yeah. Stay off a glass of wine Monday to Thursday.
Right.
You know, not that it's a huge glass of wine, but yeah, it's nice to feel that, you know, you can do things that you would have otherwise thought, you know, slightly difficult, challenging, sure, or different. Hopefully this year, maybe a little bit more time on a surfboard.
Wow.
But, you know, okay, it's finding the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I found the beaches, but it's finding the
time. Brilliant. Well, thank you very, very much. I think that's as nice a note as any to leave it on. So thanks very much for coming in, Clive.
It's a real pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal, or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.